And now, America Grows Wings. Your narrator is Tex McCrary.
From New York City, the United States Army salutes the United States Air Force on Air Force Day and brings you historical highlights of the Air Force. This transcribed feature is another in the series of
The Voice of the Army.
This is the story of a dream shared by only a handful of men in the beginning, a dream ridiculed and hampered in the beginning, a dream that finally came true through the courage and devotion to duty of the pioneers who believed in the air age. This is the story of a mighty power for defense, the United States Air Force. And how did it all begin, this Air Force of ours?
I'll tell you how it all began, Mac. It began when the brass hats in Washington read about the Wright brothers.
My good man, you're entirely incorrect. History shows that military men had considered the possibilities of aerial warfare long before the Wright brothers made their first flight. Why, in our own Civil War, both Union and Confederate forces employed balloons for observation purposes.
Oh, that ain't no Air Force, Bud. He's talking about a real Air Force.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, there's no need to argue because you're both right.
What, huh? Man?
Sure, the Air Force did have its official beginnings when the top leaders of the Army, the brass hats as you call them, authorized air experiments. And this gentleman who talks of balloon observation, he's entirely correct, too. Because military men were looking to the air even before the Civil War.
When did the Army begin heavier-than-air work?
Well, suppose we start at what you might call the beginning, August 1st, 1907, the date the Aeronautical Division of the Signal Corps U.S. Army was formed.
Signal Corps? What's the Signal Corps got to do with it?
My good man, everyone knows that the Signal Corps was the parent organization of the Air Force. Now, will you please let this gentleman continue?
All right, all right.
Well, as I said, the date was August 1st, 1907. But even afterwards, the formation of this aeronautical division, balloons, or lighter-than-aircraft, as they were called, were the standard equipment of the Army. But interest was mounting in heavier-than-air machines. On February 10th, 1908, the Army signed a contract, a very historical contract with the Wright brothers, for what was to be America's first military airplane. In September of that year, Lieutenant Tom Selfridge and Orville Wright made ready at Fort Myer, Virginia, for the first test flight of a military airplane. But that flight was ill-fated. A propeller flew off in midair. The plane crashed, killing Lieutenant Selfridge and injuring Orville Wright. Tom Selfridge was America's first Army air casualty. And then for a while, the airplane's military future looked dim.
What happened?
Yes, what did the Army decide to do after that crash?
Well, the Army's decision blamed a mechanical failure for the accident, and so another test was arranged. A year later, in July 1909, Orville Wright and Lieutenant Frank Lahm tried it again at Fort Myer.
All right, Lieutenant, the plane's ready.
Thank you, Sergeant. Well, Colonel, with your permission, sir, I'll take her up.
Lahm, I think you understand what this means. You should fail, too. Remember last year when Selfridge...
I've never been more sure of anything in my life, Colonel.
Go to it, then, and good luck.
Yes, sir. Okay, Sergeant.
Safety belt's tight enough, Lieutenant?
I think so, Sergeant. How's the engine sound?
Purring like a kitten, sir. Purring like a kitten.
Okay, then I'm ready.
Right, sir. Good luck, sir.
Locks out!
Locks out!
Yes, they made it, and Lieutenant Lahm's flight at Fort Myer was history. He was one of those many early air pioneers whose names have become immortal in Air Force history. Men like Billy Mitchell, Hap Arnold, Toy Spots, and Jimmy Doolittle.
I suppose the Air Force developed very quickly after these early flights.
I'll say it did, and as a matter of fact, it was in the First World War that the Air Force really found itself.
Wasn't the equipment crude?
Crude? Where do you get that crude stuff? Our Air Force has never had crude equipment.
Well, gentlemen, by modern standards, they certainly were crude. No jet jobs, no streamlined design, no high-caliber weapons as we know them today. But in April 1917, our pilots thought they knew the last word in design, and they did. At that time, we had only 78 flying officers and only 7 squadrons.
Is that all?
That's all.
What on earth could we do with that small force?
Well, with the help of British and French airmen, we did it. American pilots went into combat flying British Camels and de Havillands and French Spads and Newports, while America's infant aircraft industry worked at top speed to supply the planes we needed. And American aces made history in European skies.
Major Al Lufbery, Wallingford, Connecticut, 17 victories. Major George Vaughan, Brooklyn, New York, 13 victories. Captain Elliot Springs, Lancaster, South Carolina, 12 victories. Captain Field E. Kindley, Gravette, Arkansas, 12 victories. Lieutenant Frank Luke, Phoenix, Arizona, 18 victories. Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, Columbus, Ohio, 25 victories.
Yes, the pioneers in our Air Force were real heroes because they believed in air power strongly enough to defend it and work for its growth in spite of everything.
In spite of what everything?
Well, there were still many people who weren't convinced that air power had proved itself. World War I only scratched the surface in showing what the Air Force could really do, and the years following the First World War were years of struggle for the air pioneers. Years of work and disappointment, years of speech-making and public relations, years of research and development, and years of flying. Our enemies, too, realized the importance of air power, because in 1933, when Adolf Hitler took over in Germany, one of Hitler's first acts was to organize and prepare for the expansion of the German Air Force.
Germany must begin now to build her air strength! Germany will have the greatest air force in the world!
Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil!
Well, I guess we showed Adolf Hitler that time. We certainly did, but it took time. Those were crucial years, the 30s, and we might not have come out on top if our Air Force hadn't quietly continued its experiments and planning.
We were ready then in 41?
Well, let's say we were ready to get ready. As far as numerical superiority was concerned, we were far outnumbered. But in 1941, our leaders were all set to place into operation the biggest air training plan in history.
When did this plan go into effect?
Well, you'll remember Black Sunday, December 7, 1941. All of us will. We were in it. The destruction of Pearl Harbor was really bad. With President Roosevelt's war message to Congress, the Air Force sprang into action. Our country became dotted with air bases, training centers, pre-flight schools, and thousands of men made thousands of new friends in the comradeship of flying.
Boy, that sure brings back memories.
Yes, it brings back memories to all of us. As the early months of the war went by, more and more aviation cadets received their wings. More and more planes left the assembly lines.
What's day? What's day? Tokyo bomb! Doolittle bombs Tokyo!
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this program to bring you an important bulletin. It has just been announced that Tokyo has been bombed by American B-25 aircraft under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle.
Boy, do I remember that day.
We all remember that day, mister. April 18th, 1942, the day the Air Force carried the war to the enemy's backyard. Jimmy Doolittle and his gang flying B-25s avenging Pearl Harbor. 30 seconds over Tokyo, we really were in the war. The American flying fortress and the Liberator became the most familiar sight in European skies from 1942 on.
Yes, and I seem to recall excellent combat coordination between the air and the ground forces in World War II.
Yes, we were mighty proud of the way the air-ground team worked out.
Sergeant Hendricks! Sergeant Hendricks!
Hey, Sergeant, the
lieutenant
wants you.
Yeah, Lieutenant?
How about it? Can you move up?
No, sir. We got to get that 88 out of there. Can't we scare up some artillery?
No, all the battalion artillery is concentrating on the main attack.
Nah. Guess we'll just sit out the war here, then. Because this M1 ain't much good against that 88. Hey, they're ours! They're ours! Boy, can we use those babies!
Oh, we can, Sergeant. Here, hand me that walkie-talkie. This is Army Red 423. Army Red 423 to Army Orange 20. How do you read? Over.
Army Orange, 2-0. I read loud and clear. What can we do for you? Over.
A little job for you. There's a Jerry 88 giving us a rough time. Can you help us? Over.
Glad to. Read me coordinates. Over.
Okay. Sherman 88 on reverse slope hill 483 at coordinates 207.14383. Over.
207.143.3, reverse slope, roger. Hang on.
Hey, Lieutenant. Think he can do it?
Just watch him.
Oh, boy, watch him.
Okay, men, let's go. Fix bayonets and let's go.
Hey, Lieutenant. Ain't you gonna ever thank the nice man?
We'll thank him from Hill 483. Let's go!
Well, I see what you mean about close coordination. Now tell me, young man, what does the Air Force think was its greatest contribution to the war?
The greatest contribution? That's a hard question to answer. The air offensive over Europe and the Mediterranean bombardment campaign, plus the Ploesti oil fields raid, all of them were vital to victory. And then there are those who hold to the theory that everything else was Bush League stuff compared to the big mission.
The big mission?
Yes, or A-Day, as the crew of the Enola Gay called it.
A-Day? What's A-Day?
August 6, 1945, over Hiroshima, Japan. A lone B-29, the Enola Gay, piloted by Colonel Paul Tibbets.
Navigator departed. On course. Coming over target in 4 minutes. Pilot to Navigator. Roger. Pilot to Bombardier. Okay, Jack, it's all yours. Pilot to crew. Just equipment. Get those dark glasses on, fellas. Bombardier to crew. Coming up target. Bomb bay doors open. Stand by. Bomb away.
A bomb.
Yes, the atomic bomb, which saved countless American lives by eliminating the necessity for invading Japan. And the bomb that ended one era and began another. The Air Force that had suffered first at Pearl Harbor, had struck the first blow at Tokyo, and delivered the final knockout punch, could report a job well done, and could now look forward to preparing for the future defense of our country. And just a year ago, on September 18, 1947, the dream of the early American airman was realized. The United States Army Air Force became the United States Air Force, a separate branch of our national defense, co-equally joining the Army and Navy in preparing for and maintaining the defense of our country. On Air Force Day of 1948, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Army, and our millions of citizens who are listening to Voice of the Army pay sincere tribute to the gallant air pioneers who paved the way for America's leadership in the air. And we salute today's airmen who are keeping that leadership intact. And now we have in the studio a top representative of this Air Force story, one of the Air Force's most distinguished veterans, the leader of the famous Tokyo raid, General Jimmy Doolittle.
It is a privilege to greet the citizens of this great country on this program honoring Air Force Day. I am proud of the history, the success, and the progress of the U.S. Airmen. And I thank the Voice of the Army for its fine presentation of our great developments in the air. This first anniversary of an autonomous Air Force is a splendid date for me to voice confidence that our Army, our Navy, and our Air Force are joined in a great unity of purpose to maintain the peace and security of this nation and of the world by a strong, effective, and economical national defense establishment. Outstanding young men are needed in all branches of our armed forces, and those who join the U.S. Air Force will benefit themselves and their country, and will aid in proving the truth of the statement seen on all Air Force Day posters throughout the land, that air power is peace power.
Thank you, General Doolittle. I know that your appearance on this program meant much to our listeners and gave added significance to the honor accorded the U.S. Air Force on Air Force Day. This program was brought to you by the U.S. Army. Your narrator was Tex McCrary and General James Doolittle, the distinguished guest. This story was written by Charles Wilkes and directed by Major Hugh K. Murray. This is Sidney Paul speaking.
This transcribed program has been another in the series of
The Voice of the Army.